I'm Tom Hall. This is Midday. The Trump administration announced yesterday changes in rules surrounding enforcement of immigration laws for people residing in the U.S. legally. If it's likely that you would take advantage of a range of social services, from Medicaid to food stamps, it will also be likely that your application for a green card or citizenship will be denied. Today on Midday, a conversation about U.S. immigration policy with three representatives of church-based relief agencies. Krish Omara Vignaraja is the president of Lutheran Immigration and Refugee Service. Carolyn Barker Villena is a senior regional director for Lutheran World Relief. Dave Cronin is a government affairs specialist with Catholic Relief Services. They join me when Midday starts, right after the news. Good afternoon and welcome. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for being with us. From the attack 10 days ago by a gunman who targeted Hispanics at an El Paso Walmart, to migrant family separations and detentions at U.S. Customs and Border Patrol facilities, to the arrest of nearly 700 undocumented factory workers in a raid in Mississippi last week, and a policy announced just yesterday by the Trump administration that will make getting a green card even harder for low-income legal immigrants. It's been a time of extraordinary turmoil in the immigrant community throughout the United States. Today on Midday, a conversation about the continuing crisis at the U.S. southern border and the human impact of increasingly restrictive U.S. policy towards migrants. I'm joined in the studio by three guests with unique perspectives on immigration. Krish Omara Vignaraja is the president and CEO of Lutheran Immigration and Refugee Service, which provides support services to international refugees. Ms. Vignaraja, whose family fled civil war in Sri Lanka for the United States when she was just 9 months old, served as policy director for Michelle Obama and previously as an advisor at the State Department. She also ran unsuccessfully for the Democratic nomination for governor of Maryland. Krish, I haven't seen you since then, so welcome back.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for coming. And Carolyn Barker Villena is a development specialist who's spent the past decade with Lutheran World Relief, a global relief agency. Ms. Barker Villena serves as the senior regional director for Latin America and the Caribbean and has just recently returned from El Salvador. Carolyn, it's nice to meet you as well.
Thanks so much, Tom.
And joining us as well is David Cronin. He's a government affairs specialist at Catholic Relief Services based in Washington, D.C. He lobbies Congress and the administration on the development efforts for Latin America and the Caribbean and international refugee issues. David, thanks for coming to you.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
So listeners, you are welcome to join our conversation. What do you think about the announcement yesterday by the Trump administration further restricting people who qualify for green cards and citizenship, et cetera? 410-662-8780, our email midday@wypr.org. Our Twitter handle is @MiddayWYPR, and we are streaming on the WYPR Facebook page. So, Krish, let me start with you. And first of all, we should say that Lutheran Immigration Refugee Service and Lutheran World Relief both have Lutheran in their title, but they are not the same organization.
Right, exactly.
So the concentration of your organization, Immigration Refugee Service, what is that?
Yeah, so our focus is really everything from resettling refugees to providing services along the border. We're really leading the charge, particularly in New Mexico and Arizona, in terms of the asylum seekers crossing the border. Everything from that to last summer, we were one of the two national organizations approached about helping when the family separation crisis hit. And so we helped reunify families. So we have an interesting vantage point in the sense that we're a faith-based organization, but you know, our clients are actually rarely Lutheran. At this stage, we celebrate our 80th birthday this year, began in 1939, resettling Lutherans displaced by the Second World War.
So you're dealing with folks who are here or on the border and about to be
exactly
here. And Carolyn, your work with Lutheran World Relief, you are sort of a little bit more back at the source, right?
That's exactly correct. Yeah. So Lutheran World Relief was founded in 1945, so a few years after Lutheran Immigration and Refugee Services. And we work around the world on development and humanitarian issues. So we work in Asia, in Africa, Latin America and the Middle East. We don't exclusively work with refugees and migrants, but that is a big part of what we're doing. So we're dealing with Syrian refugees, we're dealing with the Venezuela crisis in South America, and then another thing that we are addressing are root causes of the migration from Central America, so from the Northern Triangle countries. So looking at the economic causes of the migration, as well as the violence and other reasons why we're seeing a lot of migration.
Sure. And Dave Cronin, your work is with legislators and people in the administration. Give us a summary of the kind of work you do and the kind of folks you talk to.
So, yeah, I guess briefly background on Catholic Relief Services. We're the International Relief and Development Agency of the Catholic Community in the United States. We operate in 114 countries around the world, serving the poor and the vulnerable. And in this context, similar to Carolyn's work in the Northern Triangle, we work in Guatemala, El Salvador, and Honduras to address the root causes of migration in terms of violence, food insecurity, lack of economic opportunity. In my work here in Washington, D.C., I want to first share and educate congressional leaders and administration officials on the work that CRS does, largely in part with the U.S. government, and to try to influence policy that is humane and just in terms of how we think, broadly speaking, about the immigration discussion, from the root causes in the region to people en route through Mexico, and again, working with partners and peers, be it LIRS or the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops, when it relates to those domestic immigration policies.
So, Krish Vigniraja, of course, yesterday we have this announcement from the Trump administration that they're going to change the rules for enforcing what's known in the vernacular as the public charge dimension of a very complicated and long immigration policy. Explain what it is they, in to your understanding, what it is the Trump administration is now going to be doing differently as of the 15th of October than heretofore has been done.
Yeah. So, you know, we're still kind of reading the minutiae in the sense that it was a several hundred page document. Part of the source that they're drawing on is actually the Chinese Exclusion Act, to give you a sense of kind of where this is coming from. And the basic idea is that if you are here,
which dates back to the 19th century.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And the underlying rule is essentially, if you were here on a visa and you were seeking permanent residence, essentially you want to get your green card, become a permanent resident and ultimately citizen of the United States, if you seek to use Medicaid or seek food stamps for your family, that will essentially preclude you from then applying for, you know, a green card or a citizenship. And, you know, we put out a statement yesterday saying this would amend, you know, Lazarus's famous poem ingrained, you know, inscripted in the Statue of Liberty of give us your tired, your poor, your huddled masses, and basically say if you're poor, need not apply. When today we actually had a U.S. government official say specifically that if you are, give me your tired and your poor, so long as you can stand on your own two feet and not become a public charge.
Let's listen. Let me just interrupt you briefly here, and let's listen to that public official I think you're referring to, Ken Cuccinelli, who is the acting director of the U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Service. This is what he had to say either this morning or yesterday afternoon. I forget.
Give me your tired and your poor who can stand on their own two feet and who will not become a public charge. That plaque was put on the Statue of Liberty at almost the same time as the first public charge law was passed. Very interesting timing.
It was a long time ago that the public charge law was passed. Congress put in the statute that if you're going to come here and you're not going to be able to be self-sufficient, we're going to restrict your ability to come here. In 2016, the United States refused 164 visas based on this public charge statute. In 2018, under the Trump administration, 5,518 were refused. So they have really ramped it up already before this law or this new, dictate for how to interpret the law goes into effect. But there are plenty of folks who say, well, look, you know, I mean, you can't just show up in the United States and expect to be taken care of. How do you respond to that?
Yeah. So I'll start from a personal perspective of when my family came. My parents came with no jobs, just $200 in their pockets and two very young kids in their arms. Both of them became Baltimore City public school teachers. My dad retired a couple years ago at the age of 80 from the Baltimore City public school system, oldest public school teacher in the state of Maryland. You know, that is the kind of family that this type of rule targets. And I only stress that because when you look at the underlying premise of the claim, it is that immigrants come over and they are leeches on the system. And the reality is so far from that, in the sense that, you know, immigrants come, they pay payroll taxes, they pay sales taxes, they pay, let's say, vehicle registration fees, all sorts of government levies. So they pay into the system. And when you look
at... And many of them even contribute to Social Security.
Exactly.
And that's not done legally, right? Because they're using identification numbers that are obtained, you know, other than the normal way, the legal way. But Social Security actually gets that money. And they, of course, have no claim to Social Security if their status doesn't change.
Exactly, right. So if you take, you know, just a simple data point of in 2015, just looking at one demographic of immigrants, refugees, they paid $20.9 billion in taxes. If you assess their spending power of what they've contributed to the U.S. economy, $60 billion. Let's look at it locally. Here in Baltimore, 9% of businesses are foreign-owned. Not foreign-owned, but they are, you know, individuals who came from other countries. Almost $1 billion of spending power is from immigrants. And this is where, you know, the idea, data point after data point, has shown that immigrants are not taking people's jobs. They are not depressing wages. And if you look at the taxes they pay in versus any sort of social, you know, services benefit, it is by far that, you know, the country, the economy benefits in the tens of billions of dollars every year.
Yeah.
And so this is where it's not just the wrong thing to do in the sense it's un-American. It's also an unwise economic decision for us to consider.
And Dave Cronin, on the Hill, what are the folks you talk to, the staffers and the congressional and Senate folks that you talk to? I mean, is there an appetite for this kind of crackdown and doing it in this particular way on the Hill?
In the work that I do, thinking internationally, you know, one of the questions that we ask ourselves in our conversations with folks on the Hill is, what does U.S. leadership look like? And Pope Francis recently talked about how can we globalize solidarity rather than globalize indifference. And the question that we ask is, how can the U.S. not only lead morally speaking in terms of how we treat people here in our own country, but how can we lead morally in terms of, you know, supporting the poor and the vulnerable where they are in their home countries? That includes financial leadership and supporting the humanitarian and development programs that myself and Carolyn's organizations implement around the world every day. You know, we can think about these issues around immigration at our border or internally within our own country, but we really need to think globally. How are we investing? How are we engaging with the world around us to ensure that people, yes, they do have the right to migrate. They do have the right to flee persecution, war, and violence. But people also have the right to stay in their home communities and thrive. And that is something that we need to push the conversation toward. And not just terms of trying to stop something, but to help people have that opportunity to thrive.
And how does that resonate with the folks that you're talking to? I mean, is that scoring?
I'd say on Capitol Hill, for decades now, we have seen broad bipartisan support for U.S. leadership, especially as it relates to humanitarian assistance, to supporting refugees, to resettling refugees here in the United States. But the challenge now we have is working with the administration to ensure that they're enacting policies that are in line with what Congress has appropriated in their annual appropriations bill for foreign assistance or what they have requested. There was a recent letter sent by 18 bipartisan members led by Senator Lankford in Oklahoma and Senator Coons in Delaware urging the administration to resettle refugees. So there is a broad bipartisan support. But how can we elevate that so that members of Congress are prioritizing how we invest in supporting the poor and the vulnerable globally?
And Carolyn Barger-Villena, you've just returned from El Salvador. You were there at the end of June. Mm-hmm. You were there for a week. When you talk to folks on the ground there, people who are wrestling with the decision, do I try to, you know, take the very dangerous journey from where they are to the United States and weigh that against the dangers they face at home? But what are you hearing? And what do folks in El Salvador know about U.S. immigration policy? Is all the information that we're bombarded with on a daily basis, you know, making it down there?
Well, you know, it's interesting, Tom, because the week that I was in El Salvador was the week that we were seeing the image of that the young man with his daughter, his one, I think, 2-year-old daughter in his arms who had drowned on the Rio Grande as they were trying to cross. And that photo was all over the newspapers in El Salvador. And I think it had a huge impact on people to see that image. And what I was hearing from people when I was down there, and again, what, you know, I was down there visiting projects that we do in collaboration with Catholic Relief Services, with funding from the U.S. government and private donors. People want to live. They want to stay in their communities. And this is exactly what Dave was referring to. They want to stay home and they want to thrive. They want to see opportunities to be able to stay in their home communities, not be threatened by gang violence, not face extortion on a daily basis, and have economic opportunities. So they're looking for stable income. They're looking for stable jobs. And that's, I think, what we can all understand. You know, this is what we all want, you know, in our lives and for our children, et cetera. So in terms of immigrating to the United States, it's the last option for most people. They don't want to do it. They would much prefer to stay home. But if they don't see any other option, and if they're in a desperate situation, that's what they're going to do, even though they recognize that there are the threats along the way, and that is a very dangerous journey.
And that often gets lost in the framing of the narrative by so many people in the Trump administration. You know, if you're going to make the decision to leave your home and go on a journey that is incredibly dangerous, particularly if you're a woman with children and stuff like that, I mean, the horrific stories that you hear, you're not going to make that decision lightly.
No.
And you're not going to do it just because you think that, you know, the United States is some gigantic sugar daddy that's going to take care of you. We'll talk about all that when we come back from a break. Krish Vignaraja is the president and CEO of the Lutheran Immigration and Refugee Service. Carolyn Barker Villena, senior regional director for Latin America and the Caribbean at Lutheran World Relief. Dave Cronin is a government affairs specialist with Catholic Relief Services. Our discussion of U.S. immigration policy continues after a quick break. And when we return, we invite your questions and comments. 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. You can tweet us at @MiddayWYPR. And you can catch us on the WYPR Facebook page as well. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us. Welcome back. I'm Tom Hall. It's midday. By the way, coming up on tomorrow's program, a look at HIV/AIDS prevention 4 decades after the AIDS epidemic began. Thanks to new preventative medications, and HIV diagnosis is no longer a death sentence, but transmission of the virus persists among certain groups, and inequities in the availability of treatment still threatens large populations across the nation and here in Baltimore. A panel of medical experts will explore where HIV prevention is working, where it's not, and what needs to be done moving forward. So that's coming up tomorrow here on Midday. If you've just joined us today, we're examining the immigration crisis on the U.S. southern border and the increasingly bleak prospects for migrants and refugees seeking asylum in the United States from all over the world because of changes to U.S. immigration policy by the Trump administration, changes that are being applauded by the president's supporters, for whom crackdowns on legal and illegal immigration were a fundamental dimension of Mr. Trump's appeal. Carolyn Barker Villena is the senior regional director for Latin America and the Caribbean at Lutheran World Relief. David Cronin is a lobbyist for Catholic Relief Services. And Krish Vignaraja is the president and CEO of the Lutheran Immigration and Refugee Service. You are welcome to join us here in Studio A, 410-662-8780. Our email is midday@wypr.org. Our Twitter handle is @MiddayWYPR. My handle is @TomHallWYPR. And you can catch us on the WYPR Facebook page. So, Carolyn, in terms of being on the ground in El Salvador, as we mentioned earlier, you were just down there about a month ago. The drivers for the people who do decide to make that perilous journey from the Northern Triangle into the United States. Tell us some of the reasons. You alluded to a couple of them, but even it's not just the poverty and the gang violence. It's climate change. I mean, there's a lot of different things that are contributing to having people make the decision to come.
Yeah, no, it's a really good point. We work with a lot of coffee farmers in the region, so not only in El Salvador, but also in Honduras and Guatemala. And one of the things that we're seeing is that coffee, along with lots of other crops, are being impacted severely by the droughts that the region has been experiencing for many years now. And a lot of that it's thought that that is due to climate change, essentially. So what happens is you have, whereas before you could sort of, the farmers knew when there would be the dry seasons and the rainy seasons and they could anticipate that. Now you're having these long periods of drought followed by very heavy rain. The rain is causing all sorts of illnesses and diseases in the plants. The drought is causing, you know, lack of irrigation. And so then you end up with very low production. At the same time, in the world of coffee, you also have the lowest prices that we've seen in over two decades. So farmers are making less than $1 per pound for their coffee, whereas a few years ago they were making above $2 per pound, and their cost of production are close to $2. So you can imagine when you have these two forces, you have climate change, you have low prices, the farmers don't have anywhere to go at that point. And so we are hearing from farmers, a lot of cooperatives, coffee cooperatives that we work with, that their members, they have many members who are making the decision to leave because they just have no other options. And so climate change is a big thing. But again, I mean, the violence that we're seeing, and violence in Central America, you know, we hear a lot about the gang violence, and we're used to that here in Baltimore. We talk a lot about gang violence. We're used to urban violence in the context of the United States. In Central America, the violence really permeates the entire landscape. So it's not just an urban phenomenon. You're seeing it throughout. In the case of El Salvador, it's a small country. You can cross the country in about 4 or 5 hours. So throughout that country, though, most communities are gang controlled. So this is the kind of thing where on a day-to-day basis, people are facing, when we talk about gang violence, I mean, they are facing it every single day. They can't necessarily go from one community to the next community because the next community over might be controlled by a different gang. So that's the kind of reality that people are facing. And along with that is all the extortion that we've heard about. I was just reading the other day that there's somewhere around $200 to $300 million of extortion payments that are made in Central America on an annual basis. $200 to $300 million in extortion. I mean, that's running an economy
for a teeny country.
This is in Central America. This is sort of the three countries of the Northern Triangle. Yeah. But when you hear that, you can see why people are fearing their lives, because they're getting threats on a daily basis from gang members to pay off these extortions, and that's not just threats directly to like the small business owner, it's to their entire family. So that's also part of why you're seeing entire families fleeing.
And Krish Vignaraja, one of the stated goals by the Trump administration is to suppress immigration, both legal and illegal immigration. So if you cross at a border, you know, a border crossing, and you request asylum, you are granted rights under the U.S. Constitution therein. If you cross outside of a legal port of entry, the rules are different. But this will have this rule which ties either the probability or the actuality of using public resources like Medicaid or food stamps, which ties that to your immigration qualifications, is a very new twist that is not only going to, it's intended to dissuade people who are in the Northern Triangle, for example, from coming, but it's also, the effect will probably be to dissuade people who are here legally waiting for their claims to be adjudicated from taking advantage of the services. That the human impact of that is stunning.
Yeah, I mean, this is where, you know, on the specific rule that was just announced, it is putting families particularly in the impossible choice of having to not apply for basic services, benefits that they are fully qualified for otherwise. But this is where, you know, to the point of what is the trajectory that we're seeing, it is this progressive sequencing of closing the golden door. So first it was trying to limit where you could cross at the border, even knowing that the Immigration and Naturalization Act didn't allow for that kind of restriction. Then it was the metering, where you could only apply at a certain time of day, and it was kind of an ad hoc basis of that official to decide. Then it was the Remain in Mexico policy, where an individual who is exercising a legal right could no longer actually come into America and had to stay in Mexico. And now the latest a couple weeks ago was what they announced was called the interim final rule, where depending on how you travel to the U.S., you can be denied. And so now if you travel through a third country like Guatemala, that is the basis for the denial of exercising a person's legal right.
And there was this supposed deal that was made with the Guatemalan government about, you know, holding asylees, people making claims for asylum. So Dave Cronin, on the Hill, mm-hmm. one of the reasons the Trump administration has given for curtailing or even ending aid to places like El Salvador, Guatemala, Honduras is that the governments are corrupt. There's just a bunch of shysters running the joint. The criminals have taken over. There's all this graft and corruption going on. So even when you send the money there to these governments are not equipped to properly take care of it and invest it wisely. What are you hearing about that?
Yeah, so an overwhelming majority of U.S. government assistance to Central America is actually provided through nonprofit organizations like Catholic Relief Services and Lutheran World Relief, or U.S. businesses that are implementing programs on behalf of the U.S. taxpayer dollar. So they're not going directly to the local governments. One of the reasons is that you mentioned that they don't want to support corrupt governments or weak governance or weak institutions. But in reality, the money that is given to organizations like CRS or partnered with organizations like Lutheran World Relief is actually getting at some of the root causes of weak governance, is getting at the root causes of violence, is getting at the root causes of food insecurity that is driving people northward to the United States. I think, for example, of one program that we have working with in schools and in school lunch programs. When the U.S. government invests in school lunches in a place like Guatemala, that program gets local civil society to the table, gets local business to the table, gets the local and national government to the table. And the U.S. government and their partners have influence on both subnational and national policy. And in that particular program, working with other partners, they were able to pass in the Guatemalan Congress a national school lunch program. That's using U.S. dollars to impact national policy within Guatemala to help benefit poor and vulnerable children who are seeking education and a way out of poverty.
Is there confidence that that program would be administered mm-hmm. honestly, forthrightly, transparently, and effectively?
Mm-hmm. Yes, the programs that we implement on the ground, we have to be obviously held accountable to the U.S. taxpayer dollar. We do rigorous monitoring and evaluation to ensure that those programs are effective and efficient, not only today and tomorrow, but years down the road. A recent evaluation of a food security project that we implemented in Guatemala found that we were able to reduce poverty by half and reduce malnutrition 5 times the national average in a 6-year U.S. government funded program. Those are results. Poverty reduced by half, malnutrition reduced by 5 times the national average. And that's a third-party independent evaluator looking at that program.
Dave Cronin is with Catholic Relief Services. Carolyn Barker-Villena is with Lutheran World Relief. Krish Vignaraja is the president and CEO of Lutheran Immigration and Refugee Services. My name is Tom Hall. Our phone number here at Midday is 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wipr.org. You can tweet us at MiddayWIPR. You can catch us on the WIPR Facebook page. And if none of those work, You ain't trying hard enough. Let's go to Facebook, where Marilyn says, what international creative efforts are in the works to improve the situation in these countries so people don't need to flee? So we talked about this just a second ago, but Carolyn, when you were in El Salvador, there are some programs that you saw that were effective, that weren't being waylaid by gangs or corrupt public officials, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sure. I can talk about the program that I had mentioned earlier that we're running in collaboration with Catholic Relief Services, and it's a program funded by USAID and the Buffett Foundation, where we are helping to revitalize the cacao sector. So cacao, for those who don't know what that is, it's basically the fruit that bears the seeds or the beans that ultimately lead to chocolate. So we're helping to revitalize that whole sector as another driver of the economy, the rural economy in El Salvador. And through that program, not only are we targeting the farmers themselves, we've also targeted youth specifically. Because again, the idea is that we are looking to establish opportunities for youth so that they don't need to migrate outside of El Salvador to look for income generate jobs, basically. So that's essentially what we've been doing. And we found, we did a certificate program with youth in partnership with one of the local universities. And the desire and the hunger among those young people, I mean, we're talking about people between the ages of about 18 to 25. I mean, just the interest, the number of applications we received from this particular area near San Miguel in eastern El Salvador was far more than we were able to absorb. And again, because there is that desire, that interest and hunger to be able to have opportunities, long-term opportunities to stay in their communities. So we are seeing those impacts.
Let's go to the phones to William in Baltimore. William, welcome to Midday. Thanks for calling.
Yes. I thought of a very simple way of handling the water problem as far as people looking for work. Back in the 70s, there used to be a program where migrant workers used to come, they would have to register, and then they would go to the appropriate farms because the work would be available. And they were pre-registered. And then they would work between 6 to 9 months, then go home for 3. And then when the season permitted it, they would go back. And because they were pre-registered, it would go that much quicker. So why don't we set up a similar program and turn the border into a temp agency and have all the employers sign up, find their workers, and if they don't, then they get punished.
All right. Thanks for that call, William. Krish Vignaraja, we had this situation in Mississippi where nearly 700 people were detained, at least for a while. They were working at food processing plants, poultry processing, I think. But the people who own that plant, as far as I know, as of today, have not been charged. I mean, there really is a double standard between the migrants themselves and the people who are employing them.
Yeah, I mean, and that's it's an important point to highlight, because I do think that there are several kind of root causes of what we're seeing. But the biggest issue, and it relates to what the caller is suggesting, is we do have a program of seasonal workers being issued visas. The issue is that we restricted this in a way that isn't at the level of what employers need. So, you know, when
we had this problem here in Maryland.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And this is where, you know, some of our biggest advocates are business people who realize that whether it is, you know, poultry and protein industry, whether it is our seafood industry here in Maryland that obviously was hurt, hit hard last summer, whether it's hospitality, hotels, there are so many industries that are affected because these are jobs that otherwise are not filled. And this is where, you know, again, you don't need to look at kind of some controversial sources for the data that proves that these employers are a net benefit. Cato Institute has showed that these jobs are only filled by immigrants and they don't depress wages. And so for us, it's a no-brainer that this is not just the right thing to do, but the smart thing to do.
Yeah, there are industries, Dave Cronin, like home health care. The people who represent those associations are very vehemently opposed to this new rule, saying that it's going to be devastating to their. I mean, corporate America is not shy about making their feelings known to Congress. What are the folks you talk to on the Hill saying that they're hearing from businesses?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think, you know, the caller is talking about, and Chris is talking about, some of the pull factors of why people come to the U.S. In my conversations with folks on the Hill about the push factors in conversations with international business or local business, we really need to improve the way we have public-private partnerships in the region to both improve security, foster good governance, and improve prosperity, so that people have not only just what some folks call kind of a handout, but really a hand up. You know, yes, it's important to talk about some of these domestic programs, but we need to be able to invest those dollars in working with the private sector in the region to ensure that people have those opportunities to work where they are. For example, in some of the youth programs that we work on in the region, very similar to the ones that Carolyn mentioned, we're able to work with over 300 companies across the Northern Triangle to allow people to kind of integrate out of our programs and into a job or back into school. One U.S. government-funded program in particular, at the enrollment period, 30% of the youth that we worked with were out of a job or not in school. 18 months afterwards, 75% of those youth were back in school or in a job. That's partially because of the relationships we build with the local government, with the local business, with the local civil society, to get people to buy in. And that's the type of argument we want to make to Congress and to the administration of how do we tie in business, not just here, but there.
Got to take a break, but I just want to make sure that I'm clear and our listeners are clear. Do each of your organizations receive funding from the federal government?
Yes.
Yes. Right. So it's federal government funding plus philanthropic dollars, the collection plates at churches on Sundays. David Cronin is a government affairs specialist with Catholic Relief Services. Carolyn Barker-Villena is a senior regional director for Latin America and the Caribbean at Lutheran World Relief. Krish Vignaraja is the president and CEO of the Lutheran Immigration and Refugee Service. We'll have more on immigration policy after a quick break. 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. You can tweet us at @MiddayWYPR. You can follow me on Twitter at @TomHallWYPR. And you can ping us on the WYPR Facebook page. Stay with us. Welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. If you're just joining us, our focus today is the U.S. immigration crisis. We're talking about the human cost of the changes to America's migrant and refugee policy being implemented by the Trump administration. David Cronin is a government affairs specialist with Catholic Relief Services based in Washington, D.C., where he lobbies members of Congress and the administration on foreign assistance and refugee issues. Krish Vignaraja, whose family came to this country as refugees from Sri Lanka when she was just 9 months old, is the president and CEO of Lutheran Immigration and Refugee Service. Carolyn Barker-Villena is the Senior Regional Director for Latin America and the Caribbean at Lutheran World Relief. She's recently spent some time in El Salvador. You can join us here on Midday at 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. Our Twitter handle, @MiddayWYPR. And we're on the WYPR Facebook page. Dave Cronin, I want to talk about what comprehensive immigration reform should look like. It seems like the whole world is for it, but particularly in the Democratic Party, I've heard not a peep about what the specifics of what it should look like. It's interesting to me that when it comes to health care, everybody, there's 24 people running for president in the Democratic Party. The four of us are the only people actually I know who are not running for president right now. And they have very specific plans about health care. They have very specific plans about a lot of things. But I don't hear a real specific plan about immigration. On the Hill, are there people promoting an immigration reform package that has any chance of bicameral and bipartisan support?
Yeah, I think, you know, the comprehensive immigration reform is obviously a very large topic, and we could be here all day discussing it. I think one example of bipartisan, potentially bicameral support for an initiative to get at some form of immigration reform is a recent piece of legislation called the U.S. Northern Triangle Enhanced Engagement Act, sponsored by the chairman and ranking member of the House Foreign Affairs Committee, Rep. McCaul and Rep. Engel, that looks at the kind of holistic U.S. government approach to immigration from Central America. That is, one, authorizing and providing foreign assistance dollars that get at the root causes of migration. And then, two, looking holistically at how the U.S. government approaches security, governance, and prosperity issues. It was passed out of the House recently and is now in the Senate. Yes, this is only one example of something that is bipartisan and potentially bicameral. But at the time, you know, when the difficult conversations are being had, we need to be able to engage on specific issues in specific times to ensure that we have just and humane policies to meet the needs of the poor and the vulnerable internationally.
There's no doubt that President Trump has an idea about what immigration policy should look like. Here's the President Trump. Here is the President last April. He was at a U.S. Customs and Border Patrol station in Calexico, California.
It's a colossal surge, and it's overwhelming our immigration system, and we can't let that happen. So, as I say, and this is our new statement, the system is full, can't take you anymore. Whether it's asylum, whether it's anything you want, it's illegal immigration, can't take you anymore. We can't take you. Our country is full, our area is full, the sector is full. Can't take you anymore. I'm sorry. Can't happen. So turn around. That's the way it is.
Krish Vigniraja, there is expectation that sometime in the next 6 or 8 weeks, the Trump administration will propose to zero out the number of refugees that the United States is accepting next year in 2020. We know what their proposal is. Does anybody else have a proposal? In your experience working with the refugees who are sometimes in the most dire straits of their entire lives, they're at the nadir of their existence, you're helping them get themselves back together. What should immigration policy look like?
Yeah. I mean, so this is where, you know, to me, it is comprehensive immigration reform, which specifically is, who are we going to kind of invite or welcome into the country? No one really is advocating for open borders. And up until recently, no one was advocating for closed borders. And so to me, it's about being strategic, but also true to who we are as a nation that largely is one of immigrants, whatever time period you came in. And so that's about, you know, being smart about business. Whether it's low tech or high tech, we know that we need these employees. You know, even in a city like Baltimore, there are some creative conversations about how can resettling refugee families here in the city address blight. It's about having some means for family reunification, and it's about having some means for refugees. Right now, we're in a time of unprecedented number of displaced people. 68.5 million have been moved for persecution, violence, war. And at this stage, for us to have gone from being a global leader, this is a program that had bipartisan support. The highest number of refugees resettled were actually resettled under President Reagan. So we have gone from 110,000 to 45,000 to 30,000. And now we are, as you said, looking at the prospects of zeroing out this program. And so to me, it's about us being thoughtful and realizing that whether we do it out of the self-interest of knowing that it is how we wage wars in the future, the refugee program is how we resettle the interpreters or the drivers who served alongside our troops and risk their lives and the lives of their families. This is why General Mattis last year said the bare minimum needs to be at least 45,000. And we believe that whether it's for that or even the fact that they're religiously persecuted, this is the program under which we accept them. These basic principles have always had bipartisan support.
And in terms, Carolyn, of asylum claims, how difficult is it for someone who is making an asylum claim from, for example, El Salvador, to prove that she is at risk of losing her life, or she is at risk of, you know, great violence if she stays in El Salvador because of her particular circumstances?
I mean, that's a great question. And honestly, I think Krish probably can answer it a little bit better than me. But I think one concern that we have is this new idea about having the safe third country option, and you mentioned this earlier, but having this agreement, the supposed agreement With the outgoing president of Guatemala, Jimmy Morales, there was just an election in Guatemala this past weekend where a new president was elected. And so what will happen with that agreement is in question. But this concept of even having a safe third country is really questionable when that safe third country itself is one of the main senders of migrants because of all of the violence that is taking place in Guatemala. So that's really concerning to us, this concept of keeping people at the border from Honduras and El Salvador at the Guatemalan border before they can even get to the U.S. border to make that request for asylum.
We have an email from a listener, Timothy, who says, I'm curious about how sanctuary works. What keeps ICE from entering a church? Has anyone ever been arrested or convicted for offering sanctuary? I mean, Chris, you deal with refugees all the time.
Yeah, so we actually launched a campaign, United Sanctuaries of America, at the start of July in response to the threat of mass deportations. And the reason we did it was because the initial target list of people and families to be deported were actually some of our clients who we were working with because they had no criminal background. They were actually part of an alternatives to detention program. And when you hear this rhetoric of, well, you know, these people have removal orders in absentia and they had their day in court, I just want to clarify, there is no legal requirement that they actually be given notice. Oftentimes, the vast majority of the people who don't show up are people where their notice was actually sent to their detention center, as opposed to the family that they're, you know, living with as their sponsor. We know that in our family case management program, over 99% of people who are given a notice to appear because they sought asylum for a reason. And to the question of how often
99%. Almost everybody is showing up because this narrative about how people just they get into the country and then they disappear and the courts never see them again.
They want legal status. They don't want to live the rest of their lives, you know, hiding in the shadows. And so that's why they show up. And this is where, you know, 88% of asylum seekers who come to the border are able to meet the threshold of showing that there is a credible fear. And so this idea that, you know, the country's full, it isn't borne out by the facts. In 1910, 14.7% of our population was considered immigrant. Today, it's 13.7%. We had 1.6 million people cross our border in 2000. And I just think that this is where it's about where we invest our resources. The reason why our immigration system is so expensive right now is because it is led largely by private prison companies and for-profit companies. And so when a child is in a facility and that company is being paid $775 per child per night to stay there, it's how a for-profit company like Caliburn gets paid $545 million just in the year in 2019.
And the financial incentive for keeping those children there is clear.
Exactly.
Yeah. Let's go to Dale in Greenmount West. Dale, welcome to the show. We've just got a couple of minutes left. What's on your mind, sir?
Hey, Tom. I'm glad to be able to get in. Look, you know, I think I've been real consistent on when I call in on immigration, and I feel like the people on the left and the right all have agendas about immigration, but y'all never talk about the actual law. The Illegal Immigration Reform and Immigrant Responsibility Act of 1996, which replaced the Immigration Reform and Control Act of 86.
And now, does that law give you a good model for where you think we should be?
Section 1324, the employers are responsible. They should be in jail just like the folks that they're rolling up under Section 1325, which is unlawful entry.
All right. Well, Dale, we are almost out of time here, so I appreciate that comment. Dave, we just have literally 20 seconds left. I mean, is there an appetite on Capitol Hill for an expansive bipartisan thing overall? What do you think?
I'm always going to choose the side of hope in the conversation around the poor and the vulnerable. And I think, you know, as long as organizations continue and faith-based organizations continue to speak out for what is just and humane, there's always a chance that we can work with Congress to pass immigration reform.
Well, faith-based, I tell you, the operative word there is faith. And we all got to have faith that the United States of America, for God's sake, can fix this. We are the United States of America. One needs to remind oneself. Well, thank you all for coming. I appreciate the conversation very, very much. I appreciate it. And we'll see you soon, I hope.
Thanks, Tom.
Krish Vignaraj is the president and CEO of Lutheran Immigration and Refugee Service. David Cronin is a government affairs specialist with Catholic Relief Services. Carolyn Barker-Villena is the senior regional director for Latin America and the Caribbean at Lutheran World Relief. By the way, looking ahead to November, there's a group called the Full Circle Dance Company. They're going to present a program called Refuge, inspired by stories from immigrants exploring the ideas of home and loss and belonging. Their performance on November 16th will benefit the Esperanza Center, which offers services to people who are new to the United States. So keep an eye out for that come November. We want to thank Joe Squared for providing lunch for our guests today. Joe Squared has been recently recognized by the Daily Meal. Menu and hours at joesquared.com. That's it for this edition of Midday. Tomorrow we're going to talk about efforts to prevent the transmission and even the acquisition of HIV/AIDS. We'll talk with folks from the Chase Braxton Infectious Diseases Center for Excellence and the Bloomberg School of Public Health, the Johns Hopkins School of Medicine, the Pride Center of Maryland, and a clinical director at the Baltimore City Health Department. They will all join me here tomorrow on Midday. Stay tuned for Here and Now. That's coming up right after the news at the top of the hour. Thanks for being with us. I'm Tom Hall. Have a great day.